KCSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Orly Lobel of the University of San Diego School of Law, author of the book Talent Wants to Be Free, Why We Should Learn to Love Leaks, Raids, and Free Writing. So this is a really interesting work that Orly's put together. Orly's written extensively over the last 10 years, not only in this area that we're going to focus on here, which is broadly how employment and human beings are used, if you will, in the flow of information, but also generally in the world of intellectual property. And so I've gotten to know her work in that community and was very excited to see this book coming out because it merges on a personal level two of my primary interests, which is intellectual property and employment and labor law. And the employment and labor law aspect is one that is not generally known because I don't write in those areas and I haven't focused on it heavily since I became an academic, but prior to entering the world of academia, I did a tremendous amount of employment and labor work, not just for the city of New York as an assistant corporation counsel, but also undergrad doing internships with a few locals, and even in practice where I did a little bit of management and labor side work, even aside from the city. But our focus today is going to be this issue that Orly delves into deeply in the book, which is this subtitle, Why We Should Learn to Love Leaks, Raids, and Free Riding. Anyone that knows even the beginning of the concepts around intellectual property recognizes and even assumes colloquially that when we talk about intellectual property, we're talking about control. We're talking about ownership of whether it's an idea, information, a trademark, or a logo, or what have you. And that issue and that concept of intellectual property has been stressed heavily by, among other things, the reality that information is hard to control. And so, playing on the phrase information wants to be free, Orly has written the book Talent Wants to Be Free, focusing on literally human beings or human capital or human resources. Now, as an undergrad in industrial and labor relations at Cornell, I bristled immediately at the human resources concept. And I, on a personal level, felt that we were talking about human beings as commodities, as things that can be owned. And so my perspective at that time was one that was very skeptical about that concept. I've come around to the notion that we really want to think about those ideas as more of information flow. And in Orly's work, she goes right after these core assumptions, almost received wisdom, that we have when we think about employment and individuals and information that are built into the law. So in the book, she has several chapters that we're going to get into here. And of course, as those of you who've been listening to the show over the past close to 8 years now know, we never get into all of the issues in the book. We can't, and many times we're merely doing tip of the iceberg. But if you look at the chapters of her book, among them are these point counterpoints, non-compete, compete, top secret, not secret. But she also talks about, and we're going to talk about the concept of the talent wars or what talent wars are. Built into the law are these notions that human beings ultimately, as employees, have a variety of responsibilities that are a conflict. But what Orly is doing in the book, and we're going to get into this thesis relatively quickly in the interview, is question those assumptions and talk about where we should be today given the technology we have and our understanding of how innovation works. So we're going to really be going through a few of these chapters in the book and then talking about this concept that Orly builds on work of others, this notion of the commons and how we might have a talent commons the way we think about other types of information sharing in other contexts. So I'm very excited to have Orly on. By way of very brief background, she is the Don Weckstein Professor of Labor and Employment Law at the University of San Diego School of Law. She teaches not only in employment law, but as I mentioned, in IP, in regulatory and admin law, torts, behavioral economics, health policy, consumer law, and trade secrets. She clerked on the Israeli Supreme Court. She also taught at Yale Law School and was a fellow at Harvard Center for Ethics and the Professions. She has written extensively, and so I could spend the next several minutes reading off her citations, but I will simply say that I'm a fan of her work, and I'm excited to have her on the show, and she is joining us from her office in San Diego on March 3rd for airing March 5th, 2014. Orly, thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So let's start off, Orly, with a question I ask most of my guests. Tell us a little bit more about your background and why you wrote this book.
So I, as you said, I'm a law professor at University of San Diego. I have taught at different law schools, and also I teach sometimes at business schools. And I wrote the book after seeing a bunch of irrationalities that come from these tensions between what we have in the legal world and what we see in reality, and how the business perspective might challenge our conventional wisdoms or our orthodox assumptions on what we need from a law perspective. So the book was really motivated by bringing together many facets of my research. As you said, I am an employment law scholar and also an intellectual property scholar. I do behavioral economics. I do a lot of collaborative work with behavioral economists and with social psychologists. And I wanted to bring together all of these different facets to speak to these various audiences and really bring together a lot of exciting work that's done under the rubric of innovation policy and human capital.
And so when we talk about these concepts, well, why don't we jump off right here? Because I asked this question pretty quickly, and you've already used it. Human capital, as I mentioned, can be a loaded term for people. What do you mean by human capital before I even ask you what you meant by the title and subtitle of the book?
Right. So you're right that it's a tricky and it's an understudied concept. So I think about human capital as all the resources and relationships and capacities that we all have in our creative worlds and in the markets to be productive, to be energetic, to work well with each other. And it's really about, you know, how we think about the knowledge, the skills, and the professional relations that are embedded in people in markets.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this title. So Talent Wants to Be Free. I don't think I'm going on a limb by saying that it builds on that concept of information wants to be free, which, again, and this is what happens when you have law professors and lawyers interviewing each other. That must mean there's a difference between information and talent. So what is talent as you're defining it in this book?
Right. Yes. So you're definitely correct that it is a play on the Stuart Brand or, you know, the kind of hacker's motto that's been around with us for a while, with information wants to be free, and challenging a lot of the lines that we've drawn with intellectual property and saying, you know, maybe there's something counterproductive in how we define some of these controls. And I come into this discussion seeing a lot of sophisticated and very heated debates in the world of intellectual property about, you know, what is the right balance between controlling and setting information free. And then under the radar, what I see and what I describe in the book is a lot of other mechanisms, design, a lot of other areas of law, contractual and regulatory law, that under the radar control much more than what we think of as just the information controls through intellectual property. So what I mean by that is that there are contractual and regulatory relations through non-competition clauses, through the way that we incentivize employees to stay or to stay in a workplace, to remain in an industry, to be productive, to be energetic, that are really about not just the information that is already out there. So intellectual property usually is regulating the ideas that are already the output of innovation, already in some ways tangible. So, you know, we call all of these assets intangible assets, you know, patents and copyright and trade secrets. But there's really a spectrum of tangibility, and human capital is even more intangible than the information that has already been created. It's really about all the potential for creativity and innovation, inventiveness that exists really in our minds and our social relations.
So let's talk a little bit about that subtitle as well, Orly. So you've got this. There are three words here, and again, this is lawyerly stuff, but it's helpful. Why we should learn to love leaks, raids, and free riding. So leaks, you know, information, you know, coming out in some unauthorized way from the source of the information, an employer or government or what have you. Raids, I think I understand to be taking your competitors or other employers' employees for your own competitive purposes. But free riding, for those that aren't familiar, might be a term of art that we want to define. So what is free riding as you use it here in the book?
Yeah, so free riding is the benefit from other companies, other firms, other people's efforts in competitive situations. So it's really going against this control mentality that I talk about in the book, where firms think that they need to internalize anything that they put into their competitive efforts. So any ideas they develop, they have to control, develop, own, and profit from, and not let anybody else in some way benefit along with them. And this is free riding is really going against this idea that this is where we should be if we want to think seriously about innovation policy and economic growth.
So the idea that you have here, I think, is one, as I mentioned in the introduction, that goes against, you know, a lot of our assumptions in the law. And perhaps we could start our discussion there. As I mentioned in the introduction, you know, hearsay culture regularly covers issues involving intellectual property and technology. And it may not be readily apparent how these issues of human capital directly relate to those questions. So perhaps, you know, if you will, how would you tie in your work into the broader debate and discussion that's been going on in the IP and technology world about who owns information and who controls it?
That's a great way to ask, I think, the kind of initial question of positioning the book with intellectual property debates more generally. So There, we have an understanding of intellectual property that we're always in this zone of a bargain, that we have intellectual property, which is a rather artificial legal creation, that for a certain purpose. The Constitution talks about this utilitarian purpose, and we always reason about the line drawing toward this goal of we want to encourage innovation, so we grant some temporary monopolies over certain types of knowledge and inventions, some creations. But we understand that this is always within a limited time. This is always going to be for certain information, certain types of subjects and certain types of creativity, but not others, because we're always in that zone of bargain, because there's a cost. There's always going to be the cost of not allowing that information, once it's developed, to be free out there to be built upon for that limited time. So we all get that, and we, as I said, we argue in a very heated way about whether we've been drawing the lines in the right place with copyright, whether copyright has exceeded in terms of time limits, with the Copyright Extension Act, are we protecting now copyright infinitely, and this really useful, or has this shifted to being counterproductive or counter the original purpose that we set to encourage more production, more creative production. We have the same kinds of debates in patent law, and every year the Supreme Court takes on new questions about patentable subject matter, about what is infringement. So we have all of these, I think, in a very visible way and in a rather sophisticated analysis between scholars and in practice and in government. This is all the time on the table, trying to get it right in all of these areas. And at the same time, I've been arguing in Talent Wants to Be Free that under the radar, we've been expanding the ways that we control innovation, control the potential for innovation, through the relationships between individuals and firms. And so, I mentioned already, the expansion of non-competes, this idea that, we are now basically all the time in every industry in any kind of position, in any type of job that one takes, it's almost standard that they're expected to sign a kind of a standard promise that they will not then compete with this firm once they leave and are out there professionally. That's one example, but there are many more. So the way that we define trade secrets and then expand them through non-disclosure agreements between individuals and firms. The way that we pre-assign innovation, more broadly defined than inventions, and we can talk about this expansion through contract of what we're trying to appropriate as firms, has just really, I think, mushroomed to something much bigger than what we think we're controlling and the kind of bargain that we think that we've drawn with intellectual property.
So we're chatting with Professor Orly Lobel of the University of San Diego School of Law, author of the book Talent Wants to Be Free on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. So Orly, let me ask you what the classic radio interview question, which is, all right, you have a number of stories. I mean, you start the book with the discussion of the Winklevosses and Mark Zuckerberg and the story of the building of Facebook, and you go from there. Is there a example or a prototype example that you would point to describe the problems that you are attempting to address here in the law as reflected in business? Is there an example that you want to lay out or a framework for thinking about the classic radio question, which is, why should we care?
Yeah. There are many examples from many different industries, but let me give you one example that might be illuminating and can also get us to some of the empirical data that we now have, which are mm-hmm. quite exciting.
Yep.
So if you think about people and how they have potential to bring a lot of innovation to industries, that is really going to affect all our lives in what kinds of offering, what kinds of choices consumers have. I think David Neeleman, who was the founder of JetBlue, is a good example of how we should care, why we should care about non-competes. In the same way that we care about Apple versus Samsung, fighting it out in the patent wars, we understand that it's not just about Apple and Samsung. It's about what kinds of choices we have as consumers and how the industry, really moves faster in terms of technological advances and the kinds of pricing that we get. So with David Neeleman and JetBlue, this is a visionary who had a lot of ideas that today we take for granted in airline, regular flights. We now think that it's obvious that we can book online our seating. We can book all kinds of choices in how we're going to travel. We have TV screens in most flights on every seat, and all kinds of customer service that has really revolutionized the industry. But he sat on his ideas. And these are ideas, this is important to note, that these are ideas that would not be patentable. You know, these are just business innovation that nobody thinks would be a subject to patent. He sat on these ideas for 5 years because he had signed a non-compete with Southwest, where he worked, promising to not be in the industry unless it's with them. So he leaves and he just takes what we call in the literature an occupational detour. He just, you know, does something else and doesn't use his talent to bring innovation into the field. What's, I think, a comparison here is that Marissa Mayer, if you take her, the CEO of Yahoo, she, you know, is this really successful Googler. She's the sexiest Googler at Google. That's what the San Francisco magazine calls her on a cover story. Just before she leaves to a direct competitor, she has a lot of great ideas on how to do online searches and to compete in the industry. And she moves seamlessly into this competitor. And why is this a difference? The exciting thing about this field of human capital law is that it's all state by state. So unlike patent law and unlike copyright law, which are all federal, we have these great variations where in California, we do not enforce non-competes, whereas in most other states, we enforce most non-competes.
So, Orly, when we think about these issues, and I do want to talk about empirical data, actually, I think this is probably a good time to do it. You know, the core assumptions that you're going after are ones that law professors certainly and academics will often just say, these are my ideas. But as you mentioned, there is empirical data to back things up. Because again, and we're going to talk about this probably after the break, you know, a lot of what you write about here is counterintuitive, which is why I think it's interesting. But let's start with that empirical data. As you think about where we are with the law versus the disconnect as you describe it in practice, what empirical data do we have to support that idea?
We have an exciting moment right now where a lot of different researchers, a lot of different disciplines, fields around campus, in different campuses, are thinking about that same question. So actually, we have this mushrooming of studies that look precisely to this question of how does less enforcement of these kinds of human capital control, how does that impact a region? How does it impact startup policies or more startup firms? How does it impact patenting? And how does it impact innovation at large? And there are different ways to study it, so I can describe, you know, different kinds of studies coming out of business schools where we code for the strength of non-compete enforcement around all the different states, and then controlling for a lot of other factors, just looking at economic growth. And comparing that to just correlations with these differences in enforcing non-competes. And there's many, many studies, but what is exciting is that we have, I think, a critical mass of this literature that all points to the same direction, that when we get less human capital controls, we get more positive effects of faster growth, more entrepreneurship, more startups, more patenting, and just a higher quality of life across the board. So more jobs created, higher paid jobs, more inventiveness in the industry in a region.
So the question then is, if that's all true, there's got to be losers here, or there's got to be others that are pushing back against it. So, you know, the societal benefits that you describe, I'm assuming have a counter, or at least, or is there a counter, or is it something else? In other words, as described, this would seem like a no-brainer, and yet it isn't, or at least it's difficult to go in that direction. Where do you see the bottlenecks or the problems associated with attempting to move the ball in this direction?
There's no denial that there are winners and losers in any regime, and in anywhere you draw the lines. So part of the message has been in Talent Wants to Be Free, is that there's a greater win-win, pie to be divided when we allow over time more of this free riding, more knowledge spillovers, more talent mobility, that everybody, again, over the long time, everybody on average benefits from. But there's no denying that when we're freezing this picture and there are talent wars, that at any given moment, somebody, some company is losing their best athlete to some other company, to a competitor. And there are risks there. There's a momentary loss. There's going to be some businesses that are going to go out of business, like in any other place. And it's kind of a risk management calculation. So one of the clear messages that comes out of looking at regional variation is that California has done very well without having non-competes, and it's actually been an incredibly innovative place and entrepreneurial place that supports a lot of ventures and growth. But there's a collective action problem there, that if we do give, it's kind of an arms race. So if we give the ability to contract for all and any human capital, once an individual comes into a company, the impulse is going to be to use all of those tools.
We're chatting with Professor Orly Lobel of the University of San Diego School of Law, author of the book Talent Wants to Be Free on KCSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KCSU-FM, which is a non-commercial nonprofit radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. So you have a couple of ways to make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you could go to our website and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to support and listen to the show. So Orly, let's get into some of these issues, because, you know, the case here seems pretty strong. And yet, at the core level, as you mentioned in the beginning, the law doesn't reflect these concepts. The law speaks in terms of ownership and property and control and strong covenants not to compete and non-disclosure agreements and so forth. And so, if we drill down on that concept, and again, and this is a complex question, so I'll ask it this way, what's missing in the law that prevents us to at least experiment more in this direction? In other words, aside from literally that covenants not to compete, with the exception of California and ours and many other places that I'm aware of that don't enforce them, indicate this, are there assumptions built into the law and our understanding of business that are ultimately at the core of where we are today?
I think there are. I think what we're missing is really this more focused thinking about the nexus between contract and intellectual property or innovation policy more broadly. So there's this assumption, I think, built into the law that, yes, we have all these bargains that are made put into how we interpret patent law, how we draw the lines in different subfields of intellectual property. But then beyond that, in these relationships between inventors, authors, creators, innovators at large, workers, and their companies, you know, whatever firms that are in the market, we're bound to get it right just by allowing contractual relations to be enforced. And I think one of the motivations that I've had writing Talent Wants to Be Free has been to shift the debate away from, is this an employment law issue? Is this a workers versus business issue? And my argument is that it's not. It's really an innovation policy issue and a business competitive issue that we have to think seriously about the talent pool, about what we have in the market in terms of cognitive capacities, potential for productive and energetic work. That is really, it goes beyond just the kind of, you know, adversarial and rather stagnated notions that we have, that anything that we're regulating in this zone is about the rights of workers, the right to work. It might also be about that, and it certainly there is a lot to say in that, you know, from that perspective, but a lot of it is just about whether we should allow through contract the subversion of the kinds of good things that we want to, that we think we're achieving by drawing the right lines in intellectual property.
So that gets us into, as we think about this, I said in the introduction, you know, that at a fundamental level, when we think about human resources, at some level, it is this notion that we're owning people. And what we're really talking about, at least the concern I hear you raising, is not as much that we need the people in place, but we need the information in place. And so the people can move around, but so long as the information that we need in order to have innovation and the know-how that these individuals have is in the right place, which may be in a variety of places at the same time, we can get what we want. And yet, we still think in terms of human beings being those vessels. So this is a somewhat abstract question, but I guess my question is, when we talk about, or when you say talent wants to be free, it seems like at one level there's an enormous overlap with that core question of how we get information into the right hands. Or is that not the right way to look at this problem?
I think it's not enough to think about just the information as fixed and already out there. I think it's really about how to create the best fit at any given moment between people themselves and the kinds of innovative work that we want them to be engaged in. So you can unpack this idea of information. If by information you just mean anything that has been coded in some way, that's where it really doesn't capture everything that we're talking about. But if we have this very broad idea of what knowledge is about, knowledge is about coded and also tacit ideas that just exist in professional networks, in the kinds of engagement and interactions between different professions, different individuals, people from different background, and they move around the market. And if we design it right, they're much more likely to come up with the next breakthrough. They're much more likely to each be more productive and innovative. So, you know, this is all the research, really, if you look at innovation research, shows that talent draws talent. In other words, if you are working in a place that is more rich in terms of the kinds of people that are there, the kind of experiences and professional background that they come with, the kinds of conversations that exist in these regions, then each person per capita, we get much, much more innovation going on.
So, Orly, let's discuss that in a little more detail, because one of the examples you use in the book, and it's one that certainly people that focus on labor policy and information control and just focus on new technological products know about, which is Apple. An Apple computer has been legendary at this point in their efforts to maintain secrecy. And, of course, the secrecy cuts across not just knowing what gadgets are coming out and when they're going to be introduced, but even goes right to the manufacturing stage. So you talk about in the book the various examples of where Apple creates a punishment system to if information is put out there. Apple would appear to be the prototype of how to be a successful company, and yet they are a company that has been heavily locked down. At least that's the general understanding of what Apple's doing. But I think you present a more nuanced description of what they're doing. And so in order to dispel some of these misconceptions, talk to us a bit about your conception of Apple as an example or a counterexample of what it is that you're focusing on here.
Apple is, of course, a fascinating example from many different perspectives, and Steve Jobs in particular is a man with many contradictions, and we're finding out more and more about the ways that he thought about secrecy and sharing and where ideas come from. Even right now, there's I can talk about this, but there's a quite interesting class action in Silicon Valley going on right now that I talk about in the book, and we're going to really keep our eye on this, where Steve Jobs really intimidated other high-tech giants, other executives like the CEO of Google and others, Pixar, Intel, to sign these agreements to not hire each other's talent. And this is going to be really, I think, a class action to watch, to think about human capital as, you know, this resource that needs to be free, and we can think about it in the same kinds of terms that we think about antitrust more generally, about cartels, human capital cartels or talent cartels, as I discuss in the book. So Steve Jobs, there's an evolution there, I think, in the ways that he thought about Apple and openness to the world, in the early days and then in the later days. We know that in the early days he would say, you know, Apple is all about looking at other places in the market, copying the best ideas, building on the shoulders of giants, getting a great idea from some competitor and making it better, doing it better. And that was the ethos, that was the culture. And I think that there is this transition and it might be a natural evolutionary transition of a company that in the early days it's very innovative and it understands its position in relation to all others in the market, and it sees how it's building on others' ideas inevitably. That's how business proceeds. That's how market competition always goes. And then at some point it kind of closes itself and forgets that history. So suddenly we see the later Steve Jobs just saying, we're going to litigate the hell out of people. We're going to go after them with patent suits just to drive them out of the market. We're going to be so militant in enforcing our own secrecy that, you know, whatever casualties are left behind, we're just gonna be fine with that. And that has raised a lot of questions about the ethics of competition, the wisdom of over secrecy. So you're absolutely right. Of course, Apple is a great example of innovation. I think that some of it has been very true, and some of it maybe is more hyped than, you know, more of a marketing strategy. We know that has been part of Steve Jobs and Apple more generally kind of business model of, we're so secret until we reveal the next prototype, which is really not that different from the previous prototype, but the consumers are so buying into this whole idea that, you know, everything's under the veil of secrecy until this final revelation, and then everybody stands in line to get, you know, the iPhone 4 or whatever the next product is. One thing is that we need to really be more nuanced about what is Apple really innovating at any given point, and what is just part of a marketing hype. Mm-hmm. We need to see and identify these contradictions of, you know, what they've been doing to others, they don't allow others to do to them. That kind of paradox that again is very pervasive in intellectual property more generally. When a company becomes so big, it becomes very proprietary. And I think that we have to open up that conversation.
We're chatting with Professor Orly Lobel of the University of San Diego School of Law, author of the book Talent Wants to Be Free. So, Orly, I'm getting close to what I call the unfair portion of the show, where I start asking questions that you feel you don't have adequate time to answer thoroughly. And then I do it anyway, hence the unfairness. So let me ask you a few questions here that kind of, you know, drive that point. So, you know, and it gets to this notion of, you know, the, if you will, to some degree, the Apple model, which seems to, even with an evolution, certainly value heavily the notion of secrecy. And you spend, to my delight, you spend at least a chapter talking about trade secrecy. And given that it is, I think, a wildly underexplored area, which is why I write in it, but more importantly, because it's a focus of your book. What is your take on the state of trade secret law writ large today? I mean, is trade secret law operating in a way that supports the way you would like to see us think about information flows and human resources, or is it an impediment? Because as you know, there is, to the extent that there's a debate in trade secrecy, one of the debates centers around whether, in fact, trade secrecy and the existence of the law helps or hinders the sharing of information, because it might facilitate licensing of information where it wouldn't otherwise. But you're really ultimately focusing on trade secrecy as an impediment through non-compete agreements and through the control of information through, and I'll ask you about it, the inevitable disclosure doctrine. But before we drill down there, writ large, what is trade secrecy doing as in terms of helping or hurting this broad issue?
Well, I think that you and I are in agreement that first thing, trade secrets is the neglected stepchild, as I think one of our colleagues has called it, of legal discourse, of intellectual property. I think you're absolutely right that we don't think about trade secrets in a focused enough way, and it's just, you're absolutely right. We need much better work and much better thinking about what we're actually achieving with current trade secret law. What we do have right now is, in the public discourse, an acceptance that clearly we need more secrecy vis-a-vis these other countries that are all stealing our secrets. So this is very much in the popular rhetoric that, you know, we just need to strengthen our trade secret laws and our economic espionage laws and make other countries comply with that, because otherwise China will steal our secrets and we'll lose our competitive edge. So first of all, there's a neglected or a forgotten history there where there's, you know, every developing country, this country, including this country, has had this history of some, you know, copying, taking secrets or whatever is defined as secrets, and in the process of getting to some stage of development. And then it becomes sort of like what we were talking about with Apple. We see this in the relationships between countries. When country reaches a certain level or a certain stage in its development, then it feels like it's on the losing side if we don't have strong enough controls and we're not internalizing all the benefits that we're creating, all the innovation that is out there to be proprietized. What is different about trade secrets and other bodies of intellectual property is that it's really abstract. And I'll give you one example of a case that I'm currently writing an article about this. The Aleinikov Goldman Sachs case, if you follow this.
Mm-hmm.
This is the programmer at Goldman Sachs, had been a programmer for several years, a star programmer, but not a trader, but he was in the high frequency trading division, just helping the system in sustaining the code for whatever Goldman Sachs was doing to make the billions that they were making. This guy decides to move on to a different job, to a hedge fund, and before leaving, he emails himself actually a really small amount of code that he had been working on. Now, this is, you know, we won't get into the details of what exactly he did, whether this was the misappropriation of trade secrets. Probably yes. You know, that it's probably very clear that he broke at least Goldman Sachs rules, but also this was what we deem trade secret theft. And I'm not on the side of saying, you know, we know that, you know, all trade secrets are, this is too much, or we're creating more impediments. We certainly need some secrecy. We certainly need trade secret law. But I think this case is very good at illuminating how much we've lost sight of what we're really trying to do and how much we're risking creating a lot of harm by just overclaiming. So Goldman Sachs picks up the phone, calls the FBI. The guy is sentenced to 8 years of prison, having never used the code that he had worked on and sent himself. Experts that look into this case post conviction are quite convinced. There's a consensus there in people who really know about high frequency trading and the kinds of code that we're looking at, that he was not intending to. It was just more of, he wanted his notebook to follow him. So he'll have it kind of in his, at some point, if he wanted to see what he did with some open source, how he combined it, how he worked on it. So again, there's one thing about breaking the rules. There might still be very much a room for some repercussions for what he did. But it's a completely different thing to imprison this person for 8 years for this kind of action. And we have to think very seriously about what we're actually allowing some companies that become so strong in claiming that, you know, everything that they're developing is so proprietary, so secret, that anybody who dares to challenge that, including and maybe actually particularly their insiders that want to leave them, we will just go along with that and be completely on board with restricting all of that.
We're chatting with Professor Orly Lobel of the University of San Diego School of Law on KCSFM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, author of the book Talent Wants to Be Free. So, Orly, I want to give you in the last, you know, we have about 5 minutes here, maybe 4 minutes. I want to give you the opportunity to tell us what the Orly Lobel world of talent looks like. And I don't mean that in the abstract. I mean that more specifically. You know, and again, we've touched tip of the iceberg. Covenant not to compete law and non-disclosure agreements, through contract, you know, run the risk of, as you've pointed out, I think very well in the book, locking down information for reasons that are not entirely clear and putting far more power into employers, if you will, than perhaps should be. We've talked about trade secrecy. Under, you know, revolving around all of this is our fear, you know, which I don't think you dispute in the book, that is certainly a concern that there's information that really can't be shared, i.e. should not be shared with countries like China that might use this technology, this technological information in ways that would harm the U.S. national interest or just harm the world more broadly. But what I want to know is, you know, if you're going to suggest, you know, two or three concrete changes in law, what would they look like? I mean, would they be getting rid of covenants not to compete? Would they be narrowing the definition of a trade secret? Something in the middle? What would that look like?
Absolutely. So you actually hit on two of several clear reforms that I have been thinking about, and I argue that we should adopt in the book. Non-competes are the strongest stick that a company can have. It doesn't define the kinds of activities, the kind of information that can be used by a former employee. It just says, get out of this industry. You know, do something else with yourself or get out of the region. Again, looking at the empirical evidence, I have my own empirical research that I didn't even get to discuss, but behavioral research that shows that this has a negative effect even on the motivation of individuals themselves to put in more effort when there's no lateral market or career trajectory to aspire to, in how they think about, you know, where they're going to go professionally. All of that, everything that we have before us from the, theoretical models, from what's going on in the law and, from the research, the empirical research, I, am a very strong believer that this is something that we don't need. California doesn't have non-competes. It has not had it for, or has not allowed non-competes in the context of employment relations ever since its inception, and we've done very well here. So taking that strongest stick off the table, that absolute prohibition, is one, you know, great start. But then there's a lot of more work to be done when we're thinking about the talent pools and human capital policy. Getting it better with definitions, defining what really is secret and confidential in trade secrets is just key. Having firms define what they actually mean by the secrecy or the information that they call proprietary, and not just kind of generally say anything and any and everything will be secret and you can't use it. That I think will have a lot of positive effects in how we see industry growth and more use of more productive use of information that should be out there and should be used more collectively. And then we didn't even talk about all the pre-invention assignments that, again, are just generic these days. Any person, not only in the high-tech industry, if you're starting at some design firm, if you're starting at the toy industry, so I talk about the Mattel case, Mattel versus MGA, the Barbie versus Bratz case. If you're starting to work at a bakery or any kind of job that you're taking, you're usually going to be signing something that says that any idea that you come up with will be owned by the company. Now, again, there's some logic in owning some of the ideas that are developed in the context of work. So this is why we have in patent law hired to invent doctrines. We have in copyright work for hire doctrines that assign those kinds of innovation that were particularly asked for in the research group, in the development context in a company, assigns it to the firm. But what we're seeing right now is this wild expansion of ideas that were not conceived during employment, that they were conceived, you know, in the weekends and nights, people that just are really creative and they have an entrepreneurial spirit. And yes, they're working right now for a firm, but they also are, you know, have this dream that one day they'll go, on their own, they'll become independent and they'll create something new. We want to encourage that. And when we allow, you know, broad assignments that, in terms of subject cover much more than what's patentable and copyrightable, when we cover much more than what is considered in just the black letter law within the scope of employment time wise, then I think we're doing more harm than any good that we're thinking that we're achieving.
Professor Orly Lobel, author of the book Talent Wants to Be Free, thank you for joining us today on the show. As you mentioned towards the end, and I share your frustration, time runs short, and there's so much good stuff in this book. Like I said, I think you wrote the book not only is there good information, but it's written in an entertaining way. But I appreciate you taking the time today to delve into at least some of these issues. I mean it sincerely when I say you were invited back on the show, if this experience hasn't been unpleasant for you, to continue our discussion, but I thank you for joining us today on the show and enlightening us to these issues, which like I said at the beginning, and you've said, don't get as much attention as they deserve.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I'm excited to mention the remaining schedule on Hearsay Culture, which goes a couple more weeks. We're looking at two more weeks for the show. Next week, Professor Jennifer Urban of the clinic at UCLA to discuss the work there. And then closing out the quarter, Ivan Krastev of the Center for Liberal Studies in Sofia discussing transparency theories. And then we are going to go into the interim period during which there will be no new shows, and we will reconvene new shows on Hearsay Culture's schedule beginning roughly in mid-April or so, maybe even the beginning of April. So, as always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen this quarter live 3 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays on KZSU, or you can stream it at kzsulive.stanford.edu, or you can listen via podcast by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, or by going to the webpage for the center at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 200-plus previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule for the show. I should mention over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be announcing some, I think, very exciting developments for the show and arrangements and partnerships that are developing for Hearsay Culture, and I'll get into that through the blog and announce those things as they become more finalized. But I should mention that to the extent that you are aware or interested in partnering or at least talking about those opportunities with Hearsay Culture, I am open to them because, again, and apropos of the topic for today, talent wants to be free. My goal is to get this information and the show out there as widely as possible. I proudly make no money off of the show. I say that proudly from a personal level. My wife and children, fortunately, able to eat, so I'm not looking to the show to pay the rent, but the point being is that I'm really interested in getting it out there, and that's my primary concern. So I'm happy to talk about any and all opportunities that you might be interested in looking in that direction. As always, therefore, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.